Coming up on Boston Public Radio, CNN's John King starts us off as the president pitches his agenda on climate change to its biggest doubters, TV meteorologists. Then we'll focus on yet another 5-4 ruling by the Supremes, saying a decidedly Christian prayer at the beginning of city council meetings is constitutionally fine. We'll ask if this is what separation of church and state means to you. Then, the House budget bans a local oyster farm in Mashpee near houses of Pat's owner Robert Kraft and his son. Slipped in secretly, run by none of the local elected leaders. We'll ask if this smells fishy to you.
Sports guy Chris Collins on the Bruins in the playoffs and Thursday's NFL draft. Is it a bigger deal now than even Election Day? Then Harvard Business School's Nancy Kane on Steve Jobs getting away with high crimes and misdemeanors because America has long given creative geniuses a pass. All that coming up on Boston Public Radio. Brady, I am Marjorie Egan. You're listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH.
Hey there, Marjorie.
Hi, Jim.
So the effects of man-made climate change are being felt in every corner of the U.S. That's according to a new comprehensive report, which was unveiled this morning at the White House. And in a Vanity Fair exclusive, Monica Lewinsky speaks. Joining us to take on these and other national headlines is CNN's chief national correspondent, John King, who is also the host of Inside Politics. Good morning, John. Good afternoon. Whatever it is. Hi, John.
Happy noon on Tuesday. I'm sorry, but I can't speak. If you read into that White House report, it says if you guys cut my segment on Tuesdays, we save climate change, hot air. All
But I'm bummed.
I don't think the hot air is coming from you, John King. I would say that right here.
It's cows, John. That's the problem. Stay away from the cows.
So, John King, President Obama is bringing all these TV meteorologists to the White House today, and some of these meteorologists, a lot of them actually, are big-time climate change doubters. It's doing this at the same time that he's releasing this pretty scary new report about the climate changes we're already feeling here in the United States. So what is this about, a new initiative? What's the method of the madness here?
Well, I think it's important to view it on two tracks. One is the policy track and one is the political track. Because Washington, especially because we're in the middle now just 6 months from a big midterm election, everybody's first instinct is politics. And he's trying to, you know, cater to the environmentalists here and make the liberals happy with him. And a lot of those environmentalists, some of them are deep-pocketed and they're helping fund the campaigns. And there's no question. There's a political environment to this. And if you don't think so, then if the president has this authority through executive action to do all this, well, why didn't he do it in the first year in office or the first term in office? Why did he wait till now? So sure, there's political. But if you read that report, even if you're a skeptic, even if you're a complete doubter of climate change, just read through the document the White House put out today. And if you don't believe there's climate change or you don't believe it's caused by humans or you think it's exaggerated, then just make a little note next to every one of those. Agree or disagree this is a problem, what would we do about it? If you don't want the government to do something about it, what would you recommend we do about it? Because if you read through it, it's pretty sobering. More wildfires, more droughts, more extreme, sudden, violent weather across all the seasons. And so, look, this is a policy conversation. It's a scientific conversation. It's a political conversation. I say this a lot on this and other issues. We should have it. And it would be nice if we could have the conversation and set aside the mistrust and the politics for a little bit. I suspect that's not going to happen.
Well, you know, speaking of distrust, Marjorie opened by saying he's doing these one-on-ones today with TV meteorologists. I don't know why I so vividly remember a story in the New York Times 3 or 4 years ago where about climate change and saying the largest subset of scientifically oriented souls who virtually unanimously don't believe that climate change is a function of man are TV meteorologists. Why did he choose them as his vehicle for getting this whole thing out? I'm really surprised.
Well, I think part of it is because of their platforms. If you think about it's the explosion of our business and that the weather slice of it, the meteorologist slice of it, gets more time on the morning shows.
Yeah,
that's
true. Yeah.
The most important time on the show.
Yeah.
Now the Weather Channel has its own, you know, there's the Weather Channel and there are other cable outlets dedicated almost exclusively to this kind of thing. And so, and look, if you're dealing with any issues, I wish when the president were talking about immigration, he would bring in, conservative writers.
I agree.
To amnesty. Talk to your critics. Try to change their minds or at least engage them, again, in that conversation. If you do that in a civil way, I think everybody wins.
You know, but John, before we leave this topic, you just asked the question that I saw you ask on television this morning, your panel at 7:30 in the morning. if he believes, if the president and his people, and what's Anthony, was it Anthony Podesta? Which of the Podestas is now helping with him?
John Podesta.
I'm sorry. If John Podesta, former chief of staff for Bill Clinton, is the facilitator here, if they both believe the president can do this by executive action, and I'm just parroting what you asked, and he doesn't need congressional approval, why did he wait till 5.5 years in? Why didn't he do this earlier where there was more time for the fight?
Well, the line you always get, and this has happened in previous administrations too, when late in the administration they start using executive action, they say, well, we had hoped because it leads to greater consensus and greater goodwill to do it through the Congress. But look, it's been pretty clear, at least since the 2010 election with the Republicans in the House, he wasn't going to get this done. But don't let me not put all the – let me try to speak English, number one. But let's not put all the blame on the Republicans. One of the president's biggest political challenges here is – you know, watch Mary Landrieu, the oil and gas state, vulnerable Democrat, yep, senator from Louisiana. Watch Mark Begich, you know, same, oil and gas state from Alaska, vulnerable Democrat. Joe Manchin, Democrat, not on the ballot this year, but from West Virginia, where the coal industry takes a big hit here. So, you know, the president has a lot of Democratic skeptics here, too. It's not just Republicans.
So let's move on for a second to this new news about Monica Lewinsky writing about her affair with President Clinton in Vanity Fair. John King from CNN, you know, Rand Paul and other Republicans have said before, and were sort of dismissed out of hand, although they may have had a point, that Monica Lewinsky and Bill Clinton's indiscretions when he was the president would haunt Hillary Clinton if she runs for president this time, which most of us assume she is going to do. So is there anything to the timing of this Monica Lewinsky thing that, you know, she has spoken before. I mean, she did years ago. She was interviewed on television about her affair. Is there any political plot afoot here with this Vanity Fair piece?
You'd have to ask Monica Lewinsky that. And I just read the piece. And I covered the White House in those days, and I did not have gray hair when it started, and I do now. We'll just leave it at that. Look, I just read the interview, and I have a great deal of empathy for Monica Lewinsky.
Me too. Me too.
What she says in the interview is it was a consensual relationship. Anyone who thinks it wasn't, you know, it is, and I still believe that, and I'll still say that. And she, even though, you know, the Clinton political machine turned on her in a violent way, she says, I could have sold a book. I could have made a bunch of money at the time. I could have sold a movie, and I didn't do it. And I went, and her, you know, her life, she's had a hard time finding work, and, you know, some people will say, so what, and other people will have empathy for her. But she makes, I think, an interesting political point. She says she was especially quiet and sort of went into hiding in 2008 when Hillary was running for president because she knew people would try to talk to her and, you know, recycle and revive her story. And then she says, well, what am I supposed to do now, hide for another 5 years? And so she's trying to gently come out and be more public about her life. I don't see in anything she said. She refutes, you know, Hillary had this quote in the Diane Blair notes we talked about, the Diane Blair archives in Arkansas, that she called her a narcissistic Looney Tune or something like that. That was Hillary's take on Monica Lewinsky.
Yep.
In this Vanity Fair piece, she does take issue with that, but almost in a sympathetic way, saying, okay, I get it. You know, the president's wife was hurt. And she lashed out at me. You know, I'm not those things, but okay, whatever. I read through it all, and I thought it was a pretty mature take from somebody who was run out of town, almost 20 years later.
Yeah, I'd say two things. When you said before it was a consensual relationship, and I believe that, were you parroting her words, or was that what you were saying, John?
That's what she said
in
the article, and that's what if I reported this issue at the time, and, you know, people talked about, you know, look, he was the boss, she was an intern, a lot of the activity, the behavior was inside the walls of the White House in the little study just off the Oval Office. I think those are the parts of it. You know, he's the president of the United States. Sometimes meetings were delayed, including with the president of Mexico and the secretary of the Treasury. I lived this, oh my God, and I'm reliving it right now. So there's a whole lot of people, but there were people who blamed her or people who said that, you know, how she was too young. This was a consensual relationship between two adults. There's a big age gap, but it was a consensual relationship between two adults. That's what she says in this article. That's what she said at the time in her testimony. And that's what everybody, once they found out about it, there were a lot of Clinton White House people who were in denial about it. And some of that, I think, was faux denial. And a lot of them actually, I think, had a pretty good sense of what was going on or pretty good suspicions. But I don't think that fact is not in dispute. You can have an argument about, you know, the appropriateness of it or in the workplace or, you know, he's the commander in chief and the leader of the free world and all that. But it was a consensual relationship between two adults.
Yeah, well, I think it can have been art.
I guess going to step in there for one second.
Well, you do it. I was going to do it. You wrote a lot about it.
Well, because I think that what feminists would normally say, although they didn't say it because they gave Bill Clinton a pass for other reasons, is that there's the power differential is so huge, and there can be no bigger power differential than between the president of the United States and an intern. So I would
You
argue,
think by definition it couldn't be consensual,
yes,
even if she thinks it was
consensual. Yeah, I think she's I think she may be deluding herself a little bit there. But anyway.
But
we'll
John, in terms of the Hillary thing. I'm reading one line. We only have an excerpt. Monica Lewinsky writing. Any abuse came in the aftermath when I was made a scapegoat in order to protect his powerful position. The Clinton administration, special prosecutors, minions, political operatives on both sides, and the media were able to brand me. That brand stuck. And she goes on to say she couldn't get a job. She was qualified for all these things. That term, the Clinton administration, this allows a new generation of reporters to try to get that question answered of Hillary Clinton, should she be a candidate? Doesn't it fairly or unfairly?
Is this part of what will come up? Hillary Clinton will, we will go through Whitewater again. We will go through Monica Lewinsky again. Yeah. We will go through just about everything that happened. There are some people who think Hillary Clinton became a United States senator in part because of the sympathy after the Monica Lewinsky scandal, that a lot of people had sympathy for her, that this had happened to her. I think without a doubt everything will be recycled and different people will process it different ways. And some voters will say, well, that was him. It wasn't her. What does it have to do with Hillary Clinton? Was Hillary Clinton part of the White House political machine that was part of the, shove Monica Lewinsky out of town and, attack the Republicans who wanted to have impeachment hearings and attack Ken Starr? Of course she was. She was instrumental part of that machine and the response, without a doubt. My own personal take is, number one, there are a lot of people listening who have no personal memory of this.
Right.
There are a whole younger generation of voters who, weren't alive when this happened or were kids when this happened. I do think, though, that if you take out the specifics, I think it is a reminder that with the Clintons, you get two very talented, capable politicians who are remarkable policy minds. I'm not agreeing or disagreeing with them, but they're fascinating people to talk policy with. You also get the circus. And some voters will have to process whether they want the circus. With the pluses of the Clintons, whether you agree or disagree with them, ideologically, they're smart people and they're very capable people. And that's a great plus. And you want ideas in politics. You want good policy debates. You want smart people who have depth and experience. With them, it's also inevitable that you get the circus.
Yeah, it is true.
That is distasteful to some people.
Yeah, it is amazing how much time people spend speculating. And maybe it's a male-female thing, but about the state of the Clinton marriage then and the state of the Clinton marriage now.
Well, you don't hear, I have to say, I almost feel like we should compliment both the media and the general public. I don't think you hear much about that now at all. Now, obviously, that's going to change should she announce her candidacy. But I think people have almost grown up. It's their business. Don't you think that's the general attitude?
No, I think there's still a big fascination about it now. And saying, a lot of people said 20 years ago, we're getting off topic here, but that she was a jerk. Why was she a doormat to this guy? Throw him out of the house. Now they're expecting their first grandchild. I think people are reassessing. Their marriage has been like a Rorschach test for a lot of American marriages.
Okay, one thing it's not going to wait for her declaration or failure to declare for the presidency is these Benghazi hearings were announced with a guy who is generally seen as a tack dog. Like this Tea Party guy was named by John Boehner as the chair of these hearings. Is this all about politics? Is this about substance? Are the Democrats going to participate? What's the deal, John King?
I'm fond of this line I spoke once months ago because I think it works. And I just say Benghazi is in the eye of the beholder.
That is a pretty good one.
In the sense that, look, four Americans were killed. Let's start there. Four Americans, including an ambassador, were killed. And there were months and months and months of warning to the State Department that the security situation was going south. So legitimate oversight is not only a good thing, it's a damn good thing. And you want to find out, why didn't the warnings get to the top? Or why weren't the warnings acted on? Because, God forbid, you don't want this to happen again, because that ambassador and those three security guys were somebody's children and somebody's husband and somebody's father and somebody's brother and sister, and they're Americans, and we are all equally responsible when we send them overseas. So on the one hand, there are people out there who say the questions have been asked and answered. The Republicans need to let this go. I would love to sign up for that crowd, completely, except just last week, a conservative lawsuit unveils another email that was not turned over to Congress that the State Department now concedes should have been turned over subject to a subpoena that was issued by Congress a year ago. And so it's when you get into these you know, look, they flunked the transparency test on Benghazi. I'm not saying there's a conspiracy theory. But when you flunk the transparency test, you feed the conspiracy theorists. And so now the Republicans are thinking that there might be more questions. There might be more documents. What else haven't we seen? And I'm sorry, you can't say that's a nutty question, because month after month, something new comes out. Are they have we had a new document that has added something dramatic or taken us factually to someplace we haven't been before? No, not really. I think the documents that we do have and the testimony we do have tells us that the State Department and the Pentagon are horrible bureaucracies where this information didn't get to the people at the top so that they could do something about it. And the warning signs, just like pre-9/11, you know, the dots were not connected, and they should have done something to improve the security, or they should have gotten those people the hell out of there, because there was ample evidence that this place was about to go south. We know that. I think there was some protecting of the president, because this all happened a couple weeks before a presidential election, and the political staff wanted to protect the president's image. You know, go figure. That will happen in every administration from George Washington, you know, through 200 years from now. Is it right? Is it unseemly sometimes? Okay, but it's not criminal. Are there other things? Well, the Republicans want to say yes. The Republicans want to say, you know, they could have gotten military troops there. I did a lot of reporting on this a year or so ago, and I don't believe they could have. They weren't close enough. Had they addressed the warnings in advance and moved a floating, you know, moved something closer, they might have been able to do something. But there was nothing they could move that fast. However, Republicans say when we keep finding out new documents, then we're going to keep asking questions. And in one way, you can't begrudge them that. That's a long answer. Let me get to the committee briefly. Nancy Pelosi said just this morning, this new select committee, she says there have been four partisan investigations in the House so far. Those are her words. If this one wants to be credible, she says Speaker Boehner has to agree that the membership of the select committee is 50-50, evenly split between the Democrats and the Republicans. If he does that, she says the Democrats will participate. If the Republicans do not do that, and that is not their plan at the moment, then I think there's a good likelihood the Democrats boycott the committee, and this will become another political football.
You know, John King from CNN, the last time we were having one of these Benghazi hearings a few months back, I had an opportunity to talk to the sister of Glenn Doherty, one of the local men who was killed in Benghazi. He had been a military guy who was doing security over there, expecting her to be wanting more answers about why this happened and who was responsible and why it couldn't have prevented and all that. And I was so surprised at the answer I got. She said she – and this is just one woman, but she's the sister of Glenn Doherty – saying she was so tired of this being a political football, and she wanted to know why the answers the politicians are seeking are not the answers about who killed her brother. You know, it's all about what Hillary knew, what Hillary didn't know. So it might be worthwhile for some of these politicians to focus a little bit more about bringing the people that committed these murders to justice. It's just.
And we should be clear, they have not been caught as of now.
Exactly. They have not.
Amen.
They have not been caught.
Amen. I agree completely. You know, why hasn't the FBI investigation moved more quickly? My colleague, Arwa Damon, sat down and interviewed the person that the FBI says is the ringleader. He was still in Libya. She sat down in a hotel coffee shop and interviewed him. That was months ago. That was part of a special hour program we did when I was doing that reporting I just talked to you about. She asked him, has the FBI talked to you? And he shrugged and said, no, but I'm right here. Come on, talk to me. Here I am. So I do think there are questions about why has nobody been brought to justice. I do think there are serious questions about, you know, why are our bureaucracies, you know, so blocked off from talking to each other. I mean, you know, Rand Paul, to his credit, I think, puts it this way. He says he doesn't believe in these conspiracy theories. What he wants to know is, if these warnings did not reach Secretary Clinton, why not? What kind of a shop was she running where somebody didn't walk in, demand a meeting, or kick her door in and say, Madam Secretary, I'm sorry, but nobody's listening. And I keep getting these reports that, you know, dozens of our people are at risk of losing their lives. And you need to know about this. You know, he asked the question that way, which I think is a much more legitimate question.
So do I.
That, you know, was there some crazy cover-up or, you know, or anything like that?
Okay, well, let's move on to the economy. The New York Times had this editorial the other day talking about how, you know, we've gotten a few, you know, employers have added jobs, but let's have some perspective on this. Wages are still flat, and 10 million people are unemployed, and millions more are so disenchanted they've given up on finding work altogether. So you have to wonder, is the economy in the 2014 elections, because things have not dramatically improved, obviously, ever going to replace Obamacare? This is GOP still going to stick with Obamacare, that pounding from now until the midterms?
I actually think that the economy is the number one issue in 2014, and the Republicans are pounding on Obamacare and pounding on Benghazi because those are sort of additional ingredients that they think excite their base even more. I think the basic climate, the threshold climate, the underlying mood in the country is set by the economy, and that's why the Democrats are in such trouble. You've got a president. Our new CNN poll has the president at 43%. Some have had him as low as 41. I've seen a recent poll that has him as high as 44. He's still below 45. But, you know, a president in the low to mid-40s, the recipe for big losses for his party in a midterm election. And why is that happening? Some of that's health care, but most of that is what people – the president rises or falls with the economy. And in our new poll out, this part of it, I think, released last night, about a third of Americans think the economy's doing well, and more than 60% think it's not. Well, if more than 6 in 10 Americans think the economy's in bad shape, guess what? That's a lot of Democrats, and that's a lot of independents. That's not just Republicans. I can tell you that of the people who think, you know, the economy's not doing so well, you know, that includes, you know, King siblings of Massachusetts, and includes a lot of people I talk to around the country. Even the people who got jobs, you know, maybe they had to take a part-time job or two part-time jobs. Maybe their house isn't worth what it was before the financial collapse. Maybe the next-door neighbor, you know, got foreclosed, or the next-door neighbor's having this issue. People feel, I liken it a lot to 1992, when George H.W. Bush was being reelected. This is obviously a midterm year, not a presidential year. But like President Bush then, H.W. Bush, President Obama now can cite a lot of very impressive statistics. The unemployment rate has come down quite significantly. Last month, the economy did add a good number of jobs. The Dow has more than doubled since he took office in 2009. So he can make a pretty good statistical argument. George H.W. Bush went around the country in 1992 saying, hey, we got 5% growth again. 5% growth. When was the last time we had that, right? And he lost a presidential election because people just didn't feel it. The last several years had been so bad that even when things started to get better, people didn't buy it or they didn't trust it. And I think that's what's happening in the country right now. And that's the biggest drag on the president of the Democrats. And then the Republicans used, you know, health care to gin up their base, to add volume, if you will, to the frustration.
You know, it's funny, John, what you just said, my assumption was because Americans generally have short attention spans, I think, because we're so busy and there's so many things going on. I assumed totally incorrectly that when the unemployment rate did drop last month fairly dramatically and when the job numbers went up almost 100,000, was it 288,000 jobs added last month, I assumed at least the initial polling after that was going to be much more positive for the Democrats and for Barack Obama, whether it should be or not. But the fact that it's still so low, despite that little burst of good news, suggests to me that while it's dangerous to ever predict long term, that there's virtually nothing that could change the, as you call it, the feeling of the American people between now and November. That's a fair statement, isn't it?
It takes a long time to shake that funk. It takes a long time to shake that funk. Even when Bill Clinton first came to office, when he won in '92, in the early months of '93, people still thought the economy was doing badly. And then what had started under George H.W. Bush accelerated under Clinton. And, you know, now Clinton's viewed as a god, right? 20 million new jobs over 8 years. It's a whole different thing. Let's see what happens. Our new poll was taken, you know, within days of the unemployment report. So let's see what they show next week and next month as we get closer. But we're 6 months from this election. And I think that people's economic pessimism is baked in. And I think it's a long-term prospect. And, look, could this president have tried to work harder with the Republicans in Congress to get more done? I think both parties are to blame. You know, the Senate Democrats passed their version of an economic plan. The House Republicans passed their version. And then they never get together to see if we could actually agree on some things. But they could probably agree on a decent chunk of stuff that would help, you know, tax incentives, infrastructure spending, that would give some jobs back, that would make it at least a little better. But they refused to even have that, back to that word, conversation. But he's the president. He's the CEO. And whether it's fair or not, that's how it works in politics.
Hey, one last thing.
Gets the blame.
One last thing about elections and blame and outcomes. So while the Obamaites might be depressed about those numbers, I guess, they're celebrating the fact that it appears, based on some of the stuff I've heard you say in the last couple of days, that we may be seeing, at least in these primaries, the beginning of the end of at least the ascent of the Tea Party in Congress. Is that what's happening?
Right now, the establishment is, to borrow that word from Mitch McConnell, crushing the Tea Party in these primaries. Now, let's watch. Some of the big ones are in the next several hours. There's one in North Carolina. In the next couple of weeks, Mitch McConnell's own primary in Kentucky. He looks okay, but let's see what happens. John Boehner's being primary today in Ohio. He looks okay, but let's, you know, sometimes the voters surprise us. Let's see how that one comes in. And then you got a big one in Mississippi, June 3rd. There are a bunch in House races over the next 6 or 8 weeks, and the establishment is spending a ton of money. I reported on Sunday that Chamber of Commerce getting involved in 10 House races this week. And right now the establishment is winning, and I cannot name for you a big Tea Party victory in a primary challenge yet this year. Still a couple months to go, but I can't name one yet. Now, so the establishment thinks it's going to humiliate the Tea Party at the ballot this year, and they may well do that. Does that mean the Tea Party goes away? No. You still have Ted Cruz in the Senate. You still have Mike Lee in the Senate. You still have dozens of Tea Party guys in the House who are, you know, the reason John Boehner can't bring immigration to the floor or so much grief when he tries to cut a debt ceiling deal with the president. My question is, so they're not going to get a lot of new members. I think that's pretty obvious out of this election cycle. But how mad are the existing members going to be that their leadership, the guys they're in the room with, are the ones who, you know, some cases directly, and in other cases did the wink and nod and had all their friends go out there and raise the money that's being used to crush these people. So you're not going to get more of them in Congress, but the ones that are left behind, they may have some serious bad blood.
We're talking with John King from CNN. One last thing from me, John. I know you're coming to Boston College tomorrow for an event. You can tell us about that in a minute. But I'm just a little suspicious that if you checked your Red Sox schedule and realized it was a home game before you agreed to accept.
Listen to that nervous laughter coming from the other end of the phone.
You know, I did check the schedule, but I can't stay for a game this time. I did check the schedule, which is why I'm frustrated. But the event will be right around the time of the game over at Boston College, and it's a great opportunity for me to have a conversation with Governor Patrick and former Mayor Menino and former Police Commissioner Ed Davis, just about leadership and their response and what lessons they've learned, and now that they have a little bit of hindsight, what they've learned about not just the bombing, but how you lead a community, and just leadership lessons. So the things they learned from that crisis that they would apply to either things they had dealt with previously, that they might handle them differently, or with the challenge they'll get tomorrow, whether they're still in political life or not. So it's a good chance to have a conversation. And the added benefit for me is I get to see my son, who's a junior at Boston College, and take him out for dinner, and that'll be a good thing. But the Fenway gets dropped for a little business and some family pleasure on this trip, but I'll get up there soon.
John, wait a second. Why did this have to be a BC? It could have been the 406 Club. I mean, come on, my friend.
That's right.
A little better planning.
Segway right over.
That's all my fault. That's true. I'm going to put you in charge of my logistics.
Now. I'll be doing that. I'm happy to. John King, great to talk to you. Talk to you next week. Good luck at BC tomorrow.
Thank you, John. John King is the host of CNN's Inside Politics, which you can catch Sunday mornings at 8:30. He is also chief national correspondent for CNN. Up next, we're going to ask you about the Supreme Court ruling. How do you feel about mixing politics and prayer? That is next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
On Campus is WGBH's higher ed desk.
Obama asked college presidents to make new commitments to help more young people go to and graduate from college.
There is this huge cohort of talent that we're not tapping.
At the White House, many schools vowed to contact high-achieving, low-income students directly and to encourage them to apply.
Listen for reports from Kirk Carapeza on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
This program is on WGBH thanks to you and Bentley University, finding common ground and new solutions for millennials and employers. You can join the Prepared You Project and offer your own insights. More at bentley.edu/prepared. And City Performing Arts Center, presenting Grammy Award winner Boz Scaggs, bringing his rock, jazz, R&B, and blues tour to City Emerson Colonial Theater May 9th in support of his latest studio album, Memphis. Tickets at citycenter.org.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marge Regan. In a major decision on the role of religion and government, a split Supreme Court, 5-4, as often is the case, has ruled the Constitution allows town boards to start their sessions with sectarian, specifically Christian-themed prayers. Justice Kennedy wrote this for the majority. This is a practice that was accepted by the framers and has withstood the critical scrutiny of time. and political change. Justice Kagan, on the other hand, disputed the assertion, saying that George Washington, Thomas Jefferson, James Madison all took pains to keep sectarian language away from public life. Quote, she said, "The demand for neutrality among religions is not a product of 21st century political correctness, but of the 18th century view." And we should be clear here that all nine justices agreed that religious opening to a public meeting like this, as long as it isn't leaning towards a specific religion, was okay. But then they were split because this was so Christian-themed, very little diversity. And we want to know at 877-301-8970, where are you on this? Is this what you believe the separation of church and state should mean? Do you see public meetings as an inappropriate venue for organized prayer, specifically, again, with a Christian theme? Or is it time to just, I don't know, suck it up and tolerate a few minutes of discomfort that might come from sitting through a prayer that you apparently may have zero belief in? 877-301-8970. And before people call, let me just get this out of the way right away, Marjorie.
What's that,
before
Jim?
People say, listen, get over this. This is not a big deal. It's done in other venues, as you mentioned in your column. If the prayer that this meeting, I think it's in Greece, New York, right outside of Rochester,
right,
instead of being Christian theme, focused on Islam, if virtually every meeting was open, do you think both the Supreme Court and a significant chunk of the American people would say, no big deal, get over it? It's not proselytizing. It's not saying you got to convert to that religion. Do you think people would be okay with that? I'd say not.
I'm a little suspicious. Or if you brought in the Wiccans. You know, you brought in the Wiccans and they had their prayer. You brought in the Baha'is or somebody else that was a little bit less mainstream. No, I'm not sure people would like it. And that was one of the points that the women made that brought this suit. One was an atheist and one was Jewish. And they both said that they felt uncomfortable and that it was weird for them in these little small town meetings to sit there and listen to while they were talking about Jesus Christ on the cross and not participate in the prayer. And they felt that people were looking at them and stuff like that. You know, here's what I think is odd. That these are town meetings. You know, what does really prayer have to do with whether somebody's going to get a variance on a zoning thing or whether...
Well, it's nothing to do with it. Except
nothing to do with it. And so if you want to... And the Boston City Council, by the way, they start all their sessions, which I was surprised to
find out. I didn't know that until I read it in your piece.
Cambridge and Brookline. We're godless in Cambridge and Brookline. We understand that. But Boston does. And they bring in a rabbi one week and a minister the next week. And they have brought in imams.
Well, that would have got... By the way, if that had been challenged, that probably would have gotten a 9-0 vote of support by the Supreme Court, because they say it's fine as long as there's diversity in terms of the religious message.
Yeah, they do. And they even had end the city council meetings. Maureen Feeney, the city clerk, was telling me this yesterday, that they end the city council meetings over there with a moment of prayer and remembrance of people in the districts who've died if their city councilors bring them in. But it just seems a weird thing. This is government business. What are we praying about at the start of these sessions? I don't get it.
Well, I mean, you're asking a narrow question. I think it's a larger question. Is this not exactly what the framers, as Justice Kagan suggested, didn't want? Essentially using a governmental forum to focus on one specific religion.
Well,
I'll say for the third time, they were 9-0 saying it's fine to open with a religious theme, a la the Boston City Council. It is not fine, said a minority. You know what's interesting about this? And I didn't realize this till yesterday. The five justices who ruled in favor of the Christian-themed prayer opening the meeting in Greece, New York, again near Rochester, are all Catholics. The three of the four dissenters are Jewish, which never occurred to me before. Obviously, the fourth, who is not Jewish, is Sonia Sotomayor, who I think is Catholic. I'm not sure. But it's a 5-4 split with Kennedy, Anthony Kennedy, being the swing vote on lots of issues, going with the conservative wing of the court. And I have to say, it bothers me, and it bothers me a lot.
You wonder whether, and I'm guessing, I obviously don't know this, but you're guessing whether they're being Jewish. They might have been used to being, certainly years ago, feeling left out of certain rituals that went on in schools before we became more inclusive in the schools. You know, if you're going to do the Christmas carols and you're going to do the Hanukkah thing and the Kwanzaa thing and trying to be more inclusive, when they were growing up, I'm betting we weren't more inclusive. When you were growing up, maybe it might not have been so inclusive, Jim.
I don't remember what it was. I went to a friend's. I went to a Quaker school, by the
Quaker
way,
school.
For 4 years.
Well, they're
at
silent
least,
all the time, right? Then you pop up
no,
and say something.
No, and you pop up and say. But by the way, some people pop up who are not Quaker. And when I went to a friend's school for 4 years, virtually, I think
Did you pop up?
The head. I can't. You were told to by a teacher if no one else popped up. As you would call it, as stood up and spoke. The headmaster of this, I think it was a K-12, but I only went through it, fourth or eighth grade, was Quaker. One of the students was Quaker, and the whole rest of the student body was not Quaker. And so some people stood up who were religious kids, spoke about their Christianity, others spoke about their Judaism, others spoke literally about the basketball game they played in. You could talk about whatever you wanted. You know, our favorite satirist, before we get to your calls, Marjorie and I both, is Andy Borowitz, who's now with The New Yorker, and he writes this morning, it's worth reading to this too. In what legal experts are calling a landmark decision on Monday, the U.S. Supreme Court struck down what many believe to be the main reason the country was started. By a 5-4 vote, the court eliminated what grade school kids have traditionally been taught was one of the key rationales for founding the U.S. In the first place, the separation of church and state has been a cornerstone of American democracy for over 200 years, said Justice Alito. Getting rid of it was long overdue. Calling the decision historic, Justice Scalia was guarded in predicting what the court might accomplish next. Quote, last year we gutted the Voting Rights Act, and today we did the First Amendment. We'll just have to see what's left. 877-301-8900.
You know, we just got an email from Art who says, the more time they take up with prayer, the less time they have to make mischief. These goobers need all the divine guidance of any denomination they can get. And that is a very good point. But the one problem with that theory, Art, is that the House and Senate in Washington begin every session with prayer. And every time you turn around, somebody else is getting indicted.
Oh, that's a very good point.
Or is making out with his little assistant there when he's, you know, a man
what's
of faith
his name,
and family,
McAllister?
Father of five. Yeah, Vince McAllister. He's a Republican. Well, that's not that that's relevant, but yes, he's not going to resign his seat, even though the woman he was making out with, you know where she is? She's gone.
Is that true?
He's holding on to a position, and she is not. Where have I heard this before?
And by the way, in the spirit of bipartisanship, if people are offended by Marjorie identifying Congressman McAllister, I don't think is running for re-election as a Republican, let's always remember Senator and Vice Presidential nominee John Edwards. 877-301-8970. Let's get to the phones. Do you think this decision was the right one? Does it trample on what you perceive to be the founders, the framers' meaning of the separation of church and state? Let's start in Weymouth with Jerry. You're on Boston Public Radio. Thanks much for the call. Hi.
Hi. Thank you. I haven't read the Bill of Rights recently, but I did read it a few times in my youth. I think that I'm not sure whether the decision is the right one, but I've always believed that the Bill of Rights guaranteed there wouldn't be a state religion and that it wouldn't keep people from practicing their chosen religion.
Right.
I don't think it said anything about God or prayer or anything of that sort. Plus the fact, as people have mentioned, we have God on our money and quite a few other places.
Yeah, but the flip side is we haven't, there are a number of decisions ages ago where creches on town hall lawns were found to be constitutionally inappropriate. So it hasn't historically been as narrowly construed, Jerry, as your interpretation. Meaning, I don't think anybody was arguing that a creche was going to establish a religion in a particular community, but the majority of justices, at least at one time, felt across the line.
Well, forgive me for my stubborn consistency, but I always thought those were a little bit narrow-minded and kind of foolish. Who cares? They also didn't want Mickey Mouse on the lawn, too, and I'm not sure that he was ever sainted, but, you know, he wasn't allowed.
Jerry, my concern about this is that this is a country where everybody, I think this is one of the things Kagan said in her decision, owns their government. And I have, while I prefer there not be any prayer at the beginning of a government meeting, I guess my fallback is where the nine justices agreed, as I said before. If they have different religions represented at each meeting, monthly, weekly, whatever it is, I'm perfectly fine. But I don't want my government creating an environment which is uncomfortable for certain people, regardless who's in the front of the room. And that's what I think, at least. Obviously, the majority of the court doesn't, was the whole purpose behind that. But, Jerry, thank you for your thoughtful call. We appreciate it.
You know what I like? I like moments of silence.
I actually do too.
Yeah. Before we begin our session today, let's just all pause, take a moment of silence, and
meaning it's do whatever you want, including nothing.
And maybe
right.
think about how well you could serve your constituents if you, you know, weren't indicted tomorrow or carrying on with some sweet young thing.
You know, this is not the single most important case of the last couple of years. We discussed the affirmative action case a couple of weeks ago out of Michigan, which I would argue has more serious implications than this. But it highlights the conversation we had with somebody a couple of weeks ago. People have to focus, and I don't care what your political persuasion, come presidential election time, on, in my opinion, other than declaring war, the single most important function a president has, appointing a justice to the Supreme Court for life. If they're smart enough, as George W. was, to pick people in their late 40s or young 50s, they can be there 30 years. They can be there through 7, 8 presidents. The power is unbelievable, and I think people have to pay more attention to that.
Keith wants to know, has anyone stopped to think about how God feels about being kicked out of numerous venues by not allowing prayer?
I don't know what that means. Dan, you're in Worcester. You're next on Boston Public Radio. Welcome.
Hi, Jim and Maggie.
Hey.
Hey, I like what you just said, Jim, about the people of this country owning the government. I'm going to give myself a dispensation from paying my income taxes this year. But one thing I want to say about this religious thing, I think a little bit of common sense from everybody. I mean, of course, you know, why would one group, one faith, have all the space at this particular meeting? Why not let everybody, all inclusive, let them do it? Everybody comes in, has their time there. I think it would make people feel more at ease. They would feel that they weren't being left out, and probably less likely to squabble about it. I mean, what harm can it do to have a prayer? I don't particularly see the reason for having a prayer at a public meeting. However, if you're going to have one, let everybody else join in, and that way there it just tempers the whole thing, and no need for this rushing to the Supreme Court.
The four in the minority basically said yesterday, Dan.
You know what one of the things is, Dan, though, that I was thinking just in terms of the pragmatic solution here? I mean, in Boston, it's easy to get all these different people from different religions because we're, you know, a pretty good-sized city and stuff. But if you're out in some little burb somewhere, especially if you're down in the South where there's a million Baptist churches and almost no temples and almost no Catholic churches, I mean, what are you going to do? Fly people in from another state so they can open the town board of selectmen with some prayer from the Quran if they're trying to be inclusive. You know what I mean?
I would say there's more diversity in other parts of the country than you think. It may not be in the same kind of numbers that it is on the coasts or in major cities or that sort of thing. But I think if you want to find it.
I was in South Carolina once. It was like a Baptist church on every corner.
Well, you know what people have? Should have binders full of people from different religions. Dan, thank you for the call. You know, while this doesn't rise to the constitutional level, every time we have this kind of conversation, I think of how much I dislike religion and politics. Who was probably the most, we've had this discussion before, the most religious president of the last 7, 8, or 9?
Carter.
And who was the one of the last 7, 8, or 9 who wore his religion least on his sleeve
when
campaigning?
Carter. And I like that a lot.
That's my view.
Remember Bill Clinton, he'd been involved in some scandal, speaking of Monica Lewinsky, as we were a few minutes ago with John King. He was involved with whoever it was, the woman of the week. You just see him coming out of a church on Sunday with his big Bible, you know?
That's what they do. They go to church.
I know.
But then when they do, it's a relatively recent phenomenon when every speech is ended with God bless you, God bless Massachusetts, and God bless America. I mean, and when politicians who are in trouble, whether it's one of these guys you were mentioning a minute ago, it's all of a sudden when they get religion. Like a lot of the Nixon guys, when they went to jail, one of them, I can't think which one, didn't he become a pastor or something?
Charles Colson. I think he was sincere, though.
Well, okay.
He just kept doing it.
Okay,
but
he did?
But this guy, McAllister, the guy that was caught...
Making out with his therapist.
Yeah. Another one of these guys that ran on the faith and family platform. I mean, that's always been my theory. The more they talk about their faith and their family, the more you got to watch out for.
Well, David Vitters, the guy from Louisiana, was the same deal. He
Big
was a family values kind of guy.
He sinned.
And by the way, just so you don't send angry emails, let me save you time. I find it comforting if someone in power, a Jimmy Carter or a city council, feels that the way they make the best decisions is to consult their preacher or to consult their inner self because they have deep-held religious beliefs, that's fine. Just don't impose them on me and don't drown me in them like a lot of these candidates and a lot of presidents of both parties have done. I just don't like it. That's not unconstitutional. I would argue this is, but five justices disagree.
Let's go to Bill from Coventry, Rhode Island. Hi, Bill.
Hello, Bill.
Hi, how are you?
Great.
Fine, thanks.
I used to teach a karate program at a Christian school. They asked me to come in and teach this program. It got up to 100 students. It was huge. It was an after-school program. It was Taekwondo, and as you know, Taekwondo has its own tenets. There's philosophy involved. But to teach it correctly, you have to teach all of that. The people that ran the school came into the program and told me I had to start teaching it without any of the philosophies at all, because they felt that it wasn't Christian enough, and all I could do is teach the Christian tenets within karate. So I found the duality in that. You know, I think it addresses this situation as well. It seems like it's fine to have a Christian stance to it, but it wasn't fine to just teach the philosophies in general. I just found that the dichotomy between the two was amazing.
Well, it's also great. But I assume the one difference, which I'm sure you're aware of, it sounds like the thing you were doing is a private setting, was it not?
It was, but you know, I found the interesting thing is they opened the program up to different religions. So you could come in from Catholic, Protestant.
Oh, really? Okay.
That's why it grew so big. So it was amazing to me that you could, you know, the prayer aspect of it. And, you know, I didn't teach it with, I mean, you could, I guess you could look at karate as that, but no one does. I was just teaching the principles that were associated with everything, like you would do in a program like
sure.
that. And they were okay with the, you know, any of the other religions aspects, but not the philosophy of Taekwondo itself.
Yeah.
So you are a former Taekwondo teacher, or are you still doing it?
I still train myself, but I don't. It left kind of a bad taste in my mouth because there was a whole thing with tithing, and they felt that I should do the program for free. And it was a long, long, convoluted story, but there were many aspects to it that were uncomfortable.
It's pretty clear in your voice. Bill, thanks for sharing the story. We appreciate it.
We just got an email from Callie who says, I'm an atheist. I'm not represented in any prayers in government. I stopped saying the Pledge of Allegiance in grade 4, and I find it offensive that God is on all my money. I'd much prefer a clean split between church and state.
So would I. I mean, that's my first preference is that. But my fallback is, as I said, where the nine justices were, at least have some diversity. And by the way, the diversity, for the most part, when people talk about diversity, I don't think they talk about having an atheist get up and do his or her talking. No, but what is it? They say, 8 to 10% of the American people theoretically are either atheists
or
agnostics.
Yeah, young people, big chunks of young
people. Is that
people.
True?
I think it's something like 30% of young people.
Is that true?
I think I read that this morning in one of these stories, yeah.
877-301-8970. We're talking about the 5-4 Supreme Court decision saying that it was appropriate, it was constitutionally fine for the Greece, New York, right outside of Rochester, city council meeting to open with Christian themed prayer. Again, 5-4. Milton, you're in Boston. You're on Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. Hi, Milton.
Hi. I'm not from this area. I'm from the South, where all those supposedly narrow-minded are.
Yeah. All the Baptist churches on every corner.
I know that. Yeah, I'm a truck driver. I'm just up here driving through town. It's not like an interesting point. As I told your interviewer, I consider myself an agnostic, but I don't wear that label. We have truck driver meetings every 3 months with our company, so the government requires it, and they always start off with a prayer. I don't care. I just sit there and I bow my head. It's not a big deal, you know. It's like, wow, there are so many more important things in this country to worry about. As far as separation of church and state, I think, and I'm not a constitutional scholar, but I think that meant that the state should not dictate what church we have or what religion
yeah.
we have.
Well, that's true.
But as far as at a town...
Or Milton, I'm, or show a preference for a particular religion, which is what at least the minority, the four... seem to think in their decision. But go ahead. I'm sorry to cut you off. Go ahead.
I am sure that if that little town in upstate New York and a Jewish rabbi came in there and everybody recognized that he was there, they would probably say, Rabbi, why don't you say the prayer? You know, I mean, it's not.
Wait, Milton, do you think in that small town, and none of the three of us have ever been there, but let's say in that small town in upstate New York, do you think if the rabbi did the prayer every single, or if a rabbi did the prayer every single meeting and it was only Jewish prayers, do you think there'd be satisfaction with that? I don't. I don't think there'd be satisfaction with that, or if there were imams every week. I think because it was the majority religion in that community, they were fine. But let me finish one thought. While you are comfortable in the truckers meeting, and I respect that, there may be, and by the way, that's a private meeting. They can do whatever they want. If someone is uncomfortable, if someone's are uncomfortable, that's, at least to me, that's the point up there in Greece, New York, then don't do it. You know, I agree with you. It's not the biggest thing in the world, but don't do it. Hey, before you go, where were you? Where's home?
North Carolina.
Oh, great. How long's the trip?
Oh, it's about 14, 15-hour drive.
Oof. Milton, call us next time you're in town. We appreciate your participating. Thanks so much for the call, Milton.
I just want to share one last email.
Sure.
That Scott said he thinks everyone would be better served to start meetings with the Pledge of Allegiance. And that's one way to go. But they did have a big fight, you know, in Brookline over the Pledge of Allegiance.
I remember that very well.
They were trying to get it out of the schools. They were trying to get out of the town meetings.
But isn't that because of the under God issue? Am I not right about that? Which was not in the original pledge, and then it was added during Eisenhower's time?
It was part of it, but some people were complaining about the idea of pledging allegiance to the United States.
Is that really true?
Yes.
That's not true.
During the Iraq and Afghanistan wars. Yeah, a big
fight. What was seen as an embrace of the Iraq or Afghanistan war by pledging allegiance? Is that what the argument was?
We shouldn't be having our children pledge allegiance to this bad country doing these bad things. I mean, that was the essence of it. But I think it did not prevail, the school committee.
You know, it's embarrassing. I was a city councilor for 2 years in Cambridge, and I cannot remember how we opened meetings.
I happened to call City Hall in Cambridge.
What did they say?
You open with the pledge.
You do?
Yeah.
I remember it well. Okay. Thank you for your calls, everybody.
Okay. Up next, when it comes to the rich, the world is their oyster. Or, in this case, maybe not. How money may have played a role in thwarting an oyster farm on Cape Cod. That is next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
All this month, the WGBH Spring Auction is your chance to bid on vacations, the latest electronics, fine dining experiences, rare collectibles, and even a brand new Toyota Avalon Hybrid XLE Premium, courtesy of your New England Toyota dealer. And every winning bid supports the news you trust and the programs you love. Special thanks to Rhodes Scholar, this year's premier sponsor. Place your bids online at auction.wgbh.org.
Funding for our programs comes from you and Cambridge Savings Bank, a proud member of the community for over 175 years, providing a full range of financial products for individuals, families, and businesses. Because legacy matters. CambridgeSavingsBank.com. And the Boston Pops. Keith Lockhart and the Boston Pops accompany a complete screening of the film The Wizard of Oz, performing the beloved soundtrack live in Symphony Hall, May 10th and 11th. Tickets and info at bostonpops.org.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. A headline in today's Boston Globe reads, "New foes never in view for Cape fishermen." Those foes aren't life-threatening sea creatures lurking in the cold Atlantic waters. Instead, they are big-moneyed residents who are operating behind the scenes to influence legislation on Beacon Hill. Last week, House leaders tucked an amendment into the state budget that would block a Mashpee fisherman's oyster farm proposal, which was long been opposed by wealthy homeowners, including the Kraft family of Patriots fame. In a couple of minutes, we're going to get your response to this. And it isn't so much, we don't really have that much information, nor do we know a lot about this individual fisherman's plight, the oyster farm plight, but it's a larger question about powerful people getting outcomes that others of us might not be able to do. Joining us before we get to you in the line to talk about what's at stake when the political process is this opaque, I guess, is Pam Wilmot. She's the executive director of Common Cause Massachusetts. Pam, great to talk to you.
Great to be here, Jim.
Hi, Pam. Thanks for joining us. Well, as Jim just said, the opaque process here, and it's a perfect word, where you have the local, you know, politician saying he knew nothing about this, and you got some politician from up in Newburyport or something inserting things into bills that affect people down in Pompanisset on the Cape. And then you can find out the crafts are involved in this. It just looks a little weird to me. Maybe
absolutely.
Even
absolutely.
Okay,
it looks like a bad spy novel. If you're a political nerd, at least, because the budget that was proposed looked completely innocuous. It was just a special coastal resource sanctuary, complete with GPS coordinates. You know, sponsored by somebody who's on the coast. So, you know, looks great, looks innocuous, probably in his area, and I think nobody even really noticed until, frankly, somebody blew a whistle. There was somebody that got suspicious, talked to Jim, who wrote the article.
Jim O'Sullivan, yeah.
Yeah.
They started doing some digging and figured actually plugged in those coordinates. I bet, you know, certainly the reps down on the Cape didn't do that. They assumed it was up on the North Shore. So it was totally news to them when it when they got a call from Jim over this I guess last Friday. So it's a classic kind of try to sneak something through and hope nobody actually does their work and notice and do it for somebody who is rich and powerful. God only knows what you know what was promised in return. We don't have any evidence that anything was, but there's got to be something there.
Well, on that note, but just stop on that note for a second. I mean, I want to highlight some of the things you said, because a lot of people are saying, well, the legislators should have read the budget more carefully. And maybe you can make that case. This is not about the legislature, in my opinion. It's about power. As you say, the GPS coordinates, not the names of the island involved. Local reps kept out of it, slipped in by a Gloucester senator. And by the way, I like Costello quite a bit. But it was at the insistence of Mintz Levin. Let's see, he's retiring, where he ends up. I don't know where he's going come January. Let's hope it's not Mintz Levin. And then the final coup de grace, talking about how much power they have, the lawyer for the Kraft Group is called by Jim O'Sullivan. The lawyer's name is Robin Glazer. And what does Robin Glazer do after saying, call somebody else? Hangs up. The arrogance of power and money. And again, this is not the biggest issue in the world. Is so underlined in the story, it is surreal.
Wait a minute. We just have to finish that point. That after this lawyer hangs up in the Globe Reporter, she refers his questions to a Kraft spokesperson who then declines to comment.
Right. It's the ultimate. So, I mean, the key here is this an aberration, or do we live through this, Pam Wilmot of Common Cause Massachusetts, virtually every budget cycle?
Well, it actually has become increasingly an aberration, which is a good thing.
That's good.
It was much more common 15 years ago or so, and they've really put the kibosh on doing outside sections. And in fact, I haven't heard of anything recently that's been quite this bizarre. There certainly is always something that gets, you know, that really is trying to be flying under the radar and wouldn't hold up to the light of day. But I'm, you know, in this day and age when we have so many resources and at our disposal, it's getting harder, frankly, to sneak things through.
Hey, I was going to ask you, I ask you anyway, and then we're going to be joined by Senator Dan Wolf, who represents the district, in a couple of seconds.
Oh, great.
But let me ask you what is appropriate for him. Now that they've been caught, and I use the word totally intentionally, are they going to undo this? Is that what's likely to happen? Or is essentially this done deal? My attitude is, even if you were totally supportive of the merits of the content of what this amendment did, the way they got to the amendment is so undemocratic, small d, undemocratic, that they should start all over again. Is that likely to happen, or is this set in stone, in your opinion, Pam Wilmot?
Well, if Senator Wolf is opposing it, and it sounds like he is based on his comments in the paper, it certainly is going to have a hard time getting through the Senate. You know, I'm not saying it won't, but it seems like it's very unlikely. Once the sort of cover is blown, it's wrong in so many ways. This is a local permitting process. This poor guy has gone through many years of litigation, of going through the local process. He's gotten approval. You know, the environmental groups are okay with it.
Yeah, it's good for the environment, the oyster beds. I didn't know that till today.
Yeah.
But hey, Pam Wilmot, thank you for your time, and thanks for the great work you do at Common Cause Massachusetts. We'll talk to you again soon.
That would be great.
Thanks.
Thank you very much, Pam.
We're going to talk to Senator Wolf in a second. I don't care whether it's good or bad, frankly.
I want things good for the environment.
I know. I'd like it to be good, too. But I don't want to see anything get in by sleight of hand. And by the way, our phone number is 877-301-8970. And while this may be less common in terms of Beacon Hill, don't forget another recent story that involved the Patriots. Do you remember when federal stimulus money, $9 million of it, was going to go to a little bridge?
Little footbridge.
Which will obviously benefit the Kraft family. It was going to happen out there at Patriot Stadium. And ultimately, and that $9 million meant that $9 million of federal stimulus funds was not going to another construction project in Massachusetts. Ultimately, it didn't happen. But, you know, another example of power trumping democracy. It's really...
And power linked, in this case, to the New England Patriots. Everybody loves around here. So I think we're joined on the phone now. Is he here?
He's here, yeah, he is.
State Senator Dan Wolf, who represents the district down there with this oyster bed near Pompanisset, had been planned.
Senator, how are you?
Thank you for joining us, Senator.
I'm doing well. How are you?
Great, thanks.
You have got a great quote on the front page of the Globe today talking about this whole shenanigans, what we've been calling shenanigans here, with putting the kibosh on this oyster bed. I just find the whole thing to be really, at best, odd, and it's not an indication of good process.
I'll get known as the senator who is good at understatement. But
yeah. Why do you find this process odd? And please elaborate if you find it more than odd, Senator Wolf.
Well, first of all, I mean, I'm being guarded with my reaction because if it's as it appears, we should be outraged by it. But we're still in the fact gathering mode. So it's odd because for a piece of legislation to be filed or an amendment to be filed by someone out of district, I guess that's not unheard of, but for it to happen without the legislators who represent that district to even know about it goes beyond odd. And the first I heard about it was when I got a press call on it. So that's really out of the box.
So let me be clear, and I think you made it clear, but I want to make it crystal clear. So Senator Costello from Gloucester, even though the bill that he filed, the amendment he filed, obviously had an impact on your constituents, not his, never consulted with you, never said, by the way, hey, Dan, I'm filing this amendment. I'll give you a chance to deal with it. You never heard about this until either the Globe or whomever or a local official contacted you. Is that what happened?
Well, Jim, first of all, let's be clear. He's a rep. He's not a senator.
Oh, rep. I'm sorry. Yeah, my apologies.
And so David Vieira, who represents in the House that district, I'm not sure that he had heard of it either, but certainly I hadn't. And the fact that, as I understand it, the amendment just contains GPS coordinates.
Yes, it does.
Would make one think that intentionally someone would not see it or it wouldn't be flagged, because otherwise you would give reference to geographical location as well as GPS coordinates. So it really does go beyond odd.
And we were asking Pam Wilmot on a Common Cause a couple of minutes ago what the shelf life of this is likely to be, and her contention was if people like Dan Wolf, who represent the district, are unhappy with the process, that the likelihood of this House amendment making it through the Senate or even making it through a budget conference committee is quite small. Is that a fair conclusion?
Well, it's disconcerting on several levels, Jim, because one of the great economic development opportunities we have in our district is aquaculture. So we're doing everything we can on the one hand to enhance that part of our economic development. And to have this happen from outside the district, really just is unacceptable. So, again, I need to get more facts. I wasn't really up to speed on the exact project. So I still need to learn more. But, yeah, I think suffice it to say it's very unlikely that I would support this as it moves through the Senate budget process.
Senator Wolf, last question for me, and I don't think you'll be offended by this. I think you'll understand the context in which prior to being an elected official, you were a founder and you're the head of Cape Air, a wonderful operation, I should say, that I've used many times myself. Have you ever been presented with an opportunity, there's a piece of legislation that mattered to you, where your advisors, your lawyers, your people you hired to lobby for you said we could slide this baby in there because people are partial to you? I'm serious, to this business. Has that ever been presented to you, or have you ever said, let's try to do something like in your private life, let's try to do something with as little fanfare as possible? Has that ever happened?
It's so funny, Jim, because, you know, we're all wired differently in the business community. It wouldn't even occur to me to use the political process. As somebody who grew up with a mother who's a historian of American history, a teacher at Penn, I really was brought up to respect the process and believe that our government works for all people in ways that are above board. It wouldn't even occur to me to try to use the political process for individual gain or for gain for my business. It's interesting you bring it up, too, because I'm in the final pages of Elizabeth Warren's new book, and just reading it, it is striking when you start to read about the influence of special interests. And, you know, in her case, it was her experience with the banking industry and the lobbyists. But clearly, people believe that it's appropriate to use the political process for their own gain or their special interests. But that's not the way I was brought up, and it's certainly not the way I'm wired.
Senator Wolf, thanks for your time.
Thank you very much for being with us. We much appreciate it. That was
great talking to you.
Great talking to you too, State Senator Dan Wolf, and of course Pam Wilmot that we spoke with before, Executive Director of Common Cause Massachusetts. Our number is 877-301-8970, 877-301-8970. We want to ask you, is this just the latest example of how we are morphing into an oligarchy? If you live in the Cape, we'd love to hear from you particularly. How do you feel about this legislation and the way it was handled? 877-301-8970. No, we neglected to say that one of the reasons that supposedly the Crafts and their other neighbors that live down there near this proposed oyster farm would be concerned about having it there, as it might spoil their views and they'd have to look at these buoys. Art just emailed and said the Crafts don't want to have to look at the buoys that will mark the limits of the oyster bed, although they're okay with the moorings from their yachts. I'm not sure if they have any yachts, but that's a good thought, Art. Christopher just emailed that he blames it all on Crafts' gal pal. Do you know? She's the young woman.
Well, if you read some of the comments on the story, they also say, what did they give the Representative Costello, an autographed Tom Brady football? 877-301-8970. Even if you're not affected by this directly at all, does this drive you as crazy as it drives me and apparently Marjorie? I am worked into a frenzy over this. 877-301-8970. And again, the part that... And you may find this odd, but I think you know this about me. My attitude is, if you believe in something then, and you're a public type, you have an obligation to talk publicly about it, or else you shouldn't do it. It's one thing that their lobbyists slid this thing in without any notice to the local officials. Another thing, they slid it in with just GPS coordinates without without any location names. But the fact that their lawyers had the audacity to say, call so-and-so.
The media.
They hang
the
up on the Globe.
Representative.
And then they call the media representative, who doesn't even think it's important enough to return a phone call.
You know what?
Is amazing to me.
Here's the deal, Jim. When you read the words slipped quietly into the budget late at night, you always know it's big trouble. There's a reason why these things are slipped in late at night. 877-301-8970. Would you like to see this little amendment slipped back out of the budget in the full light of day?
Even care about it slipped out. I want people to apologize.
To get his oyster bed, too. I would like this poor guy who's been trying all these years to get his oyster bed. He's on the front page of the Globe. Looks like a regular guy just trying to put an oyster bed there.
We don't know enough. I mean, it sounds like it's a project
He doesn't look like an irregular guy.
No, he doesn't.
He
doesn't.
Looks like a regular, normal person there trying to get an oyster bed going. Let's go to Paul from – I'm not sure where you're Paul.
Oh, Paul, you're from the Mass Fiscal Alliance, which is an organization
in Massachusetts.
Hey, Paul, what's your take on this?
Hey, thanks for taking my call. My take on this is that, you know, right now we're talking about the Globe story when we slip in a piece of amendment. But last year, you may recall, the legislature slipped in a major tax increase to the tech community. And the process itself is broken. And it's not just me saying this. It's other groups. You look at, like, the Sunlight Foundation, and they talk about the budget process in Massachusetts and how it's very hard for anyone to see through the opaque. It's actually darker than that. You know, the whole budget process in itself needs to be completely revamped. And, you know, a lot of reviewers and readers and listeners know, but even committee votes, I mean, those aren't even public in the legislature. It's unheard of.
Well, Paul, by the way, for those who don't recall, the tech tax was repealed when there was a public outcry about 2.5 minutes, not quite literally, after it was passed. But I think unlike this, there were some major players on Beacon Hill who were fully aware of it and were talking about it. And in fact, some of the people who urged repeal on the tech tax were candid enough to say, we were part of the problem. We should have fought harder. We should have been clear on this thing. So I'm not saying it was a perfect process at all. But by comparison, this is like a sleight of hand, middle of the night kind of thing, not with maybe the same impact as the tech tax, but not quite as slimy, for lack of a better expression, as this this oyster thing. But, Paul, thank you for the call. We appreciate it. 877-301-8970. I'm like, my body is vibrating. I don't know what it is. It drives me crazy.
But you know what, Paul, it reminds me of something that we've talked about for years. I mean, way back to when Billy Bulger was the Senate president, which is a long time ago now, yeah. About things being slipped into the budget late at night with no one having any idea they were slipped in. And suddenly you had certain people getting jobs, certain people getting favors, certain wired people using their political connections to get their way. And so it is a big deal that these things are slipped in, Jim, in the wee hours.
And by the way, when people – I have no idea what campaign contributions come from the Kraft family. But when people say, well, these kinds of things don't matter – if you have power and money, you have access. Trust me, everybody. If you were opposed to this oyster farmer in Mashpee, and you're just an average citizen of Massachusetts, and you call Representative Costello on the phone instead of Mintz Levin, the firm, calling him and say, Representative Costello, here are the coordinates. Could you slip a ban on this oyster farm into the bill? Trust me, there'd be an oyster farm. It's just there's this disparity that is really undermines democracy.
David from Kituit. Oh, you're on the Cape, David. What do you think?
Hi, David.
Well, I'm from the Cape. I'm in the car. But, yeah, I'm completely outraged about this, but not surprised. This is just the latest in the total takeover of the waterfront down here on the Cape by the wealthy, and it's been going on for years. You know, they're always trying to push through private piers, which I regard as a public, private taking of public property. When I was a reporter at the Cape Cod Times, I covered a shellfish hearing where this lady in a Lily Pulitzer skirt complained to the shellfish board that the clammers were only a 9-iron shot away from her deck. These people are out of control, and we've got to reform these colonial, beach rights that give these people the right to the beach all the way down to the water.
Hey, David, if you are, let me interrupt you to say, if you're a former reporter, it's interesting the name Marjorie just mentioned. You know who the single greatest fighter in my lifetime in Massachusetts for beach rights for average people? Against the wealthy landowners, as you call them, they was Bill Bulger.
Yeah, well,
that
maybe
was
that was
a relentless cause.
Maybe that was before he got his land down there in Cape Cod. They
well,
have a whole compound down there now. But what is it, David, as I recall, and correct me if I'm wrong, the way it works on a lot of these beaches on Cape Cod that people have houses in front of, private homes, you can walk by the beach, but you can't sit down. You have to keep moving. Is that the deal?
Oh, you can't sit down, but if you go down there to fish, they've got, security guards down there. They've got some guy in a pair of, go to hell pants screaming at you to get off of his jetty. They're insane. And you've got to look, I go out of my way to walk on their beaches holding a clam license or a fishing rod just to stay within my rights. But no, they're terrorizing everyone. They pay a huge amount in property taxes, so the towns bend over backwards for them.
Yeah.
Give them exceptions to mooring permits and just do everything in their power to keep these people happy. Meanwhile, they just, continue to tear down houses, build their starter castles, and, it's a disaster in the making.
Why did you ever leave reporting? You really have a way with words, David.
Thanks
for the
call.
Thank
you, David. It is
a great call.
It is an amazing thing. You know, most of these very huge houses on the Cape, you can't see them because they're behind these long driveways. But if you get somebody to take you out in a boat, and then you see these places from the water, you just can't believe it. It's like the Vanderbilts and the Rockefellers.
Or the Bradys and the Bunchens. I say one thing about it? I'm glad he raised the point that he raised. We should do this another day.
What?
If people buy the property, I don't like that people, for example, there was an article in the Globe about a third Koch brother. Remember this fight against the wind farm?
Yes.
Where he's been buying up virtually all the land. You're entitled, it's legal. We don't like it. We'd like there to be more, what's the fairness, more equity in all this kind of thing. However, what David just brought up is the most important fallback is at least have beach access. People shouldn't own. I don't care whether you're rich, poor, middle class. You shouldn't be able to own up to the water so that people can't even walk along the beach. It's sort of like a fundamental natural right, I guess.
I thought you can walk, but you can't
No,
fish.
I'm not. We should check on this.
I wasn't sure if you could sit down
My understanding.
Not. I guess you have to dog paddle 15 feet
No, I thought
from the
shore. Property rights in some cases, maybe I'm wrong about this, we'll check, extended into the water.
No.
So in any case, whatever it is, I mean, it's not
so
healthy.
So if you can't swim and keep going for 2 miles, you're out of luck.
Oh, my goodness. In any case, thanks for your calls.
Up next, sports reporter Chris Collins joins us for some Tuesday afternoon quarterbacking. That conversation is next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Even oligarchs have lawyers.
They should be given basic rights of defense, so the opportunity to say, this is wrong, I shouldn't be here.
The legal battles that come from international sanctions and a lawyer who needs a special license to even get paid by her own clients. Next time on The Takeaway from PRI, Public Radio International.
This afternoon at 2 here on 89.7 WGBH.
WGBH programs exist because of you and Boston 2034, a day-long event on June 10th showcasing ideas, innovators, and companies poised to drive the exponential economy in the years ahead. More at xconomy.com/Boston2034. And Gentle Giant Moving Company, serving New England since 1980, now offering moving and storage services coast to coast with offices in major cities across the country. More info at gentlegiant.com.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I'm Jim Brown. She's Marjorie. It is a huge, huge week in Boston and New England sports. Here with us, in a Bruins hat, I should say, to discuss all this is sports reporter Chris Collins. Hello there, Chris.
Homer Collins.
You are exactly.
That's what you're calling me from now on.
Okay. Thank you for coming in, Chris Collins. Great to see you. So, I'm not a sports expert, but Jim
I've never heard that before.
Yeah,
from
Jim has been coaching me on this, and we got a piece of sound.
But Jimmy is a sports expert.
Well, by comparison, yes,
yeah,
I am.
Compared to relatively me, I guess speaking. he's a sports expert. But he's been talking to me all morning about this whole how big the NFL draft has become, and it's like a multi-day event. It's starting, I think, tomorrow.
Thursday.
I'm
or
sorry.
Tomorrow.
So 2 days.
Whenever Marjorie wants
Whenever.
To start it,
okay.
You start it when you want.
It's coming soon. In any case, here, listen to this sound from NFL Commissioner Roger Goodell announcing the first pick in the 2013 draft.
With the first pick in the 2013 NFL draft, the Kansas City Chiefs select Eric Fisher, tackle, Central Michigan.
You know what it's like? It's like someone saying, and the next president of the United States is Barack Obama.
Well, it sounds like
the Chippewas.
You're in the middle of the Coliseum or something with the Roman gladiators.
Well, it was, it was a one-day thing, then it was a two-day thing, and then it just keeps getting bigger and bigger. Now it's like a primetime thing. It always used to be on traditionally on the weekend, like a Saturday, then a Sunday, and they closed the doors on Sunday. Now, they put it in prime time. The ratings were that big. There was so much interest in it that people were just, first of all, getting a football fix kind of as we head towards the summer. Second of all, everybody really, wants to know what the heck their team is doing and where they're headed into the next season. You look at the Patriots. Is that your next question?
No, I was going to ask you, do people bet on this? Are they doing the brackets?
I don't think they bet on it, but it's such a big deal because you want a player who can come in and make an immediate impact. You want a guy who can change the game for your team for that upcoming season. And, a lot of the teams are either, one or two players away, and then on the other spectrum, they need somebody to go cheer for. If you're not winning games, you need something to root for, and that's what you root for. It's kind of like spring training, really, where spring training everybody has a chance.
Yeah,
the draft, same type of deal. Everybody has a chance if you have a good draft.
Okay, so that thing, somebody to cheer for, covers somebody. I don't want to spend much time on Johnny Manziel. Obviously, was the star. He won the Heisman 2 years ago, right?
Yeah. What do you call him? What's his nickname for you?
What is he?
Probably call him like Johnny Golf.
Well, what is he? Johnny Football?
Yeah, Johnny Football. Would be
the guy I want to know about, remember, Michael Sam comes out, soon to be allegedly the first openly gay player in the NFL. Everybody says a really good football player. He was first team, whatever conference he's in. And then all of a sudden we start reading in the last week or so, Chris, well, he's really too small to be a defensive end. Well, he's too slow to be a linebacker. Is this a prelude to him not getting drafted and people saying, no, it has nothing to do with his sexual preference, sexual orientation. It has everything to do with the fact he's just not good enough to play pro football.
Well, to the critics, to defend the critics, they did kind of say that as soon as he came out. he's always been, you know, even when he was in the closet, he still was a little bit undersized. He's kind of a tweener. You know, he can't quite, you know, be big enough to take on, you know, the big fullback and the defensive lineman at linebacker. He's not quite quick enough to be a defensive, you know, so he's kind of right in between. Now, with what you're saying is, understand this. The one thing coaches hate, I mean, you hear Belichick say it all the time. What's the biggest thing that he wants to just rid from the planet?
Distractions.
And the drama. The
distractions.
Drama. Yeah.
Exactly right.
Yeah, the drama.
And all that stuff feeds into it, okay? So you're talking about the opening of training camp. What's everybody doing? They're talking about Sam's, you know, being the first openly gay player. Again, he's the first one who come out and admit to being gay in the media.
Right.
Plenty of guys have been in the locker room, and everybody, you know, including the coaches, have known this guy or this guy or this athlete has been gay.
Not openly. By the way, we should say Chris's brother-in-law is a former pro football player, so he knows of what he speaks.
I don't know how it has to do with anything.
Well, because you actually know these people. This is, you're not a, like a side, you know, whatever yeah. it's
well,
called. You're not like an armchair.
I'm in the locker room. I know enough of these guys to know that. I mean, there certainly has been instances where guys have been gay in the locker room, and you know what? It is what it is. But again, back to that. It's not all the coaches, but certainly some of them will have a bias. And the bias isn't that always gay. The bias is that, oh, no, he's taking away from what we're trying to do here, which is a win Super Bowls. You know, we don't want that extra added attention. We don't want another story. Belichick's always trying to get rid of the stories.
Exactly.
But kind of why I don't buy in. That. The reason I don't buy that at all is what is a bigger distraction? An openly gay football player or an alleged murderer? And I'm serious. And Belichick answered questions once about this, and he said, I'm never answering questions again. How is that, the fact that they have an alleged
Jimmy,
murderer?
You've got a way.
I think, frankly, the gay guy is a bigger distraction.
Well, I really do.
Yes, absolutely. In the NFL, it's still
considering that there have been many other murderees.
Exactly. And people with long rap sheets and guns and knives,
you know,
and girlfriend problems.
After, like,
else.
You know, if you have, you know, 50 or 60 openly gay guys who come out, and then, it's no longer a story. Because you're right. Because when you look at the rap sheets of a lot of these guys on these 53-man rosters, I mean, there's pretty much a roster where there's a plethora of guys who have done something that you wouldn't necessarily be proud of. Okay. But again, all this gets trumped by one thing. I mean, if the guy goes out and he's a legitimate playmaker, if this guy's a top 10 pick, he's still a top 10 pick. He's not going to slide because he came out. If he can go out and make plays, make an immediate impact, be an all-pro type of player, he's absolutely still going to remain, despite any distraction, a top 10 pick.
Let me ask you one last thing about Michael Sam before we move along. So was the consensus among sports writers that he made a big error by coming out before the NFL draft?
Well, I don't think that was an error. I think that was the circumstance that he was presented. I think it was so well known.
Okay.
And
he had told his teammates long before.
Long before. They played the whole entire year.
Okay.
And even before that, his teammates said, really? We know.
Okay.
But again, when they start investigating, you know, when they start investigating potential draftees, I mean, they get into everything. So I think it was more of a full disclosure. Let me just put it out there before.
Okay.
And I can control the message as opposed to someone else investigating, figuring out that I am openly gay, and then they control the message. So I think that was calculated by his agent. I don't think he had much of a choice.
Okay, let's switch sports. And since you're wearing a Bruins hat, let's do the Bruins next. This is PK Subban for the Canadiens, nailing the game winner against the Bruins in double overtime in game one last Thursday. Here it is.
Pierre and Gallagher, they win the draw. Barkov, Subban shoots, he scores! PK Subban! And the Montreal Canadiens have defeated the Boston Bruins in game one, 4-3.
And of course, everybody knows, as we discussed yesterday with the two reverends, that the fact that Subban was a black player led to all those grotesque racist tweets. But before we get to that, I am now becoming a Canadian, hockey fan. I'm sorry.
You're a Canadian
in my
fan?
Later life.
Is that a Freudian slip?
Is the Canadian Bruins rivalry comparable to the Yankee Red Sox rivalry? It is. Is it not?
In the world of hockey, no question.
But
I would call it the most heated rivalry in hockey. You know, two original six teams. Those are, you know, two of the first six teams.
I understand the concept.
Got to fill Jimmy in as I go.
I appreciate that.
So two original six teams with a long history of bitter rivalry. And the thing about the rivalry is that it was so heavily dominated, you know, by the Canadians for you know, basically four decades until finally the Bruins have figured things out. And the Bruins have gotten the best of the Canadians lately. But again, I mean, this thing started as a rivalry that was dominated by the Canadians, much the way the Yankees dominated the Red Sox.
You know, Subban, I thought, was great. We haven't talked about this part of it. We should have mentioned. Subban was great. When he was asked by reporters about this the other day, he said, this doesn't represent the Bruins. Well, this doesn't represent. Let me finish this. And said, I'm not going to talk about this again after this first time. Dan Shaughnessy and others criticized both the mayor of Boston and the Bruins for even acknowledging these racist tweets and apologizing for them. Where do you fall in this, Chris Collins?
I think the Bruins had to say something. I mean, it was so, you know, it was so vocal or so, you know, viral that you just couldn't ignore it. But again, you know, that's part of the fan base. And I know the Bruins denounce it as they should, but it still is part of the fan base. I don't think there's any question that, you know, especially hockey, because there just isn't that many black faces, okay? And I think you look at it that way because there are some minorities and some Native Americans, but there's just not that many black faces out there. Yeah, go ahead, Marjorie.
Well, that was one of the – oh, thank you very much, Chris Collins.
I mean, you were raising your hand.
I raised
like
my hand.
We're in the second grade here.
That's what I have to do to get Jim to let me say something over here. I raised my hand. Anyway, we had Irene Monroe here, Reverend, yesterday, and she was saying that one of the things that she thought was a big deal about the Bruins case was what you just said. There's not many black guys playing hockey. And, you know, the poor white guys, every time black guys get into the sports, they suddenly take over the sport, and the white guys are all pushed out. So this is like – this is part of this this pushback.
Well, that
like,
can never happen in hockey. You know why, right?
Why?
Oh, we're warm weather people. I hate that. I'm not going to play on a sheet of ice.
Okay. Well, that was one of her theories. That, oh, here we go again. The big star of hockey, which we thought was a white guy sport, becomes now a black guy. That there was a jealousy there.
You know what? I don't know if it's a jealousy, but it certainly is a routine, a custom, something what hockey fans are accustomed to.
Yeah.
You know, not seeing, you know, obviously basketball and football are heavily dominated by African Americans, and this is a sport that isn't. And, you know, I look at the thing. I mean, I've looked at this thing 100 times. First of all, Subban. I mean, if you listen to Subban and the way he represents himself, I mean, to me, it's a disgrace that they just boo him. Because, I mean, when he answered those questions,
he
yeah. answered them like he went to Harvard.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, he completely turned the whole story back on, you know what, this is about hockey. This is about, you know, this league, and we should be better than this, and it's not about, you know, one guy. I mean, he completely did what the critics of Subban say he can't do or he doesn't do, which they say, well, he's all about me, he's flashy. But again, to me, if you look at hockey and you look at a player like that who's extremely talented, there certainly are some cultural differences in the world of hockey that you certainly do not see in the world of
That's
hockey typically
point.
That you may see in the NBA.
That's a great point. Let me ask you one last thing about this whole Bruins thing.
You know where Subban's brother plays, right?
Bruins.
Yeah, he's in the Bruins organization. Yeah.
I mean, you've been a reporter for a long time, Chris Collins. A lot of these commenters in general, whether it's about race or about women or about people that are that are not like basic old white guys, they're really vicious in general because they're anonymous.
Yeah.
How do you feel about it? Do you feel this is elevating the business or?
Well, we've had this conversation before because we talk about the posts, you know, when Jimmy or yourself write something and, you know, there's, you know, the real Jim Browdy posting, you know, nasty things. It's comical at the same time. When it's about you, it's not so funny. But, you know what? It's so, you know, when it comes to race and it comes to things, you know, not just the typical, all right, Jimmy, you suck, or Marjorie, you're terrible. No, we're not talking about that.
Yeah.
We're talking about when they go above and beyond.
Yeah, N-words.
N-words, when they're putting race into it, when they're saying things about your family and your mother. Of course, you know, it's cowardly. And
we know that. We only have 30 seconds. I am usually not the optimist about these things. I buy the notion that these are the real outliers. And I think most sports fans' position is, if you're good and you win – I don't care who you are. I don't care what color your skin is.
I don't know.
Wait a second. How many of these
I think you're
giving – I'm not – they were venal. They were disgusting. How many were there? 100? 200 out of millions of fans?
I hope you're right.
I think it's the hockey thing. Little vermin is what they are, and I don't think we should give them more play than they deserve. In any case.
I question it. You know, I do. And I look at, you know, when Subban touches the puck, and there have been some awfully, you know, big villains – in the Boston-Montreal series. But the way they boo him, and I know they boo Chara up in Montreal, but the way they boo him, you kind of wonder if there isn't a little race mixed in as well as him being a great player.
I hope you're wrong. Chris Collins, great to see you.
Chris Collins is a sports reporter. Great to talk to you, Chris. Up next, Harvard Business School's Nancy Kane with her ethics about Silicon Valley. It could be a place with no ethics at all. That's next on 89.7.
The great relief pitcher Mariano Rivera retired last year. Now he devotes himself to his church. Does he ever watch a Yankee game and think, man, I wish I could come in from the bullpen right now?
I always have that feeling.
You always have that feeling.
That feeling will never go away.
The Closer opens up on All Things Considered from NPR News.
This afternoon at 4 here on 89.7 WGBH.
This program is made possible thanks to you and Lahey Health, committed to providing leading-edge care right in your community, helping you become and stay healthy all through your life. You can learn more at LaheyHealth.org. That's LaheyHealth.org. And Boston Playwrights Theater, presenting the 16th Annual Boston Theater Marathon, 50 10-minute plays by 50 New England playwrights in 10 hours, May 11th. Tickets available at BostonPlaywrights.org.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I'm Jim Browdy. She is Marge Regan. One of Apple's famous ad campaigns was Think Different. Shouldn't it be differently? In any case, and with Steve Jobs, thinking different also meant breaking the rules. But at what point does breaking the rules mean breaking the law? Recent New York Times article points out how Jobs defied the law. It's a way of doing business that his Silicon Valley descendants appear to be embracing. Here with us in Studio 3 to talk about what happens when enterprising startups think the rules don't apply to them is Nancy Kane. Nancy's an historian at the Harvard Business School, where she holds the James E. Robison Chair of Business Administration. Her latest book is Ernest Shackleton, Exploring Leadership. Hey there, Nancy.
Hey, folks.
Hello, Nancy. So good to see you. So Steve Jobs, I suppose none of us are that surprised, turns out was an outlaw. I guess the question is, and you could detail his problems, or some of them are alleged problems, but in any case, the piece in the Times that was talking about this kind of left you with the impression that this is what geniuses have done down through history. So does it matter? Is he an outlier in being the genius and doing these things, or is this just what they do?
I think that's too broad and too categorical kind of, you know, file to put Steve Jobs and other, you know, other entrepreneurs' behavior in with regard to, say, the tech world right now. I mean, clearly, you know, In America, the history of innovation, disruptive innovation, has been a history in which the laws are often made reactively. So there isn't an antitrust act, for example, Sherman Antitrust Act, the most famous set of precedents governing that kind of behavior on the part of corporations. There isn't a Sherman Antitrust Act until 1890, and it's formulated partly in response to the rise of big companies, in this case particularly the Standard Oil Trust Company, founded by John Rockefeller and some of his colleagues and family members. And so the law has this reactive element to it in which, you know, organizations and individuals surge ahead in disruptive ways. Incidentally, one of the actions that Steve Jobs is in this article, right, accused of or imputed to be engaging in is illegal antitrust behavior, violating the Sherman Antitrust Act.
Which appears, by the way, based upon my reading, I'm not an antitrust expert, reading the New York Times article, he was guilty as charged, but never charged. Is that not?
That's certainly the way it smells within the article. I mean, it's more specifically for our listeners who haven't perhaps read the article, in the instance that Jim and Marjorie are talking about, Jobs engaged in several different behaviors, did several things to basically prevent any kind of poaching of Apple employees by competitors or other like companies such as Google, and that is a form of antitrust behavior. You can, in some sense, limit workers' options and competition for workers, just like you can't, as a company head, collude with other company heads. Incidentally, the price fixing in book price sales is another example in which perhaps Steve Jobs and other tech executives colluded to set lower bounds on the price of books. So the larger historical point is that the law is rarely proactive. So is Steve Jobs the first disruptive entrepreneur to perhaps go beyond the bounds of the law? No. Is it a necessary condition of productive or unproductive innovation and entrepreneurial path breaking that you break the law? Absolutely not. And that is the curious implication of the second half of this piece, that somehow folks like Steve Jobs or Brian Chesky at Airbnb, right, who's run into a whole big regulatory and thus legal tiff with New York regulators and other state regulators around residence requirements and rental issues, because lots and lots of Airbnb landlords, people renting out their space, seem to be doing it not on a case-by-case basis, but on a large-scale mass case.
Well, before you go ahead, let me just say, for those who haven't heard about it, and I've used it, it's essentially hotels online. They don't comply with the regulations. They don't pay the hotel taxes, all that sort of thing. And that's the legal dispute that Nancy's speaking about, which we'll get back to.
Right. If you read the press around this kind, and it's literally an interchange, they're both writing each other in public venues, the New York State Attorney General and Brian Chesky. Or if you think about Uber, the car service, right, the limo car service company that's growing rapidly, and the kind of price gouging accusations they faced around tripling, quadrupling, and increasing prices even more during snowstorms in New York, and in which case Travis Kalanick, the CEO of that company, said, well, look, this is disruptive. We're not like a taxi cab service. We shouldn't be subject to kind of price bounds in the same way. They're all Jobs, Chesky, Kalanick, making a version of the argument that because we're new, providing a service people want, we don't have to worry so much about regulation because we're not like the companies these regulations were formed to deal with. You know, that's the implication of the second half of this story. And I'm here to say as a historian that categorically defying existing laws is not a prerequisite or is not necessarily positively correlated with entrepreneurial success and productive innovation for society at large.
Well, this New York Times piece also talks about Steve Jobs being very involved in this options backdating scandal that came through Silicon Valley about 8 years ago, and that five executives of other companies went to prison for backdating options, but Jobs was never charged. Now, he was sick, as we know. He had pancreatic cancer and ultimately died. But this is heavy-duty stuff, backdating options, isn't it?
I actually went back and did some homework on this. I had read a lot about this a couple of years ago when I was putting together the unit in my class on Steve Jobs. And Walter Isaacson, the very, very articulate and diligent and intellectually substantive biographer of Steve Jobs, who wrote a no-holds-barred authorized biography on which Jobs had no control save for the cover photograph, right? He goes through this in great detail, and so do a lot of the business press at the time. And here's the rough lay of the land of that story. So once upon a time, Steve Jobs joined Apple again as CEO. This is in the mid-later 90s. Came on, I think, unofficially as interim CEO. They called him CEO, small I in front of CEO. These folks think differently and they are clever. In 1997, and took no pay. He took a dollar for the first several years of his CEO term. And one of the members of the board, Edward Woodard, on the Apple board, pressed him in the late 90s to take some compensation. And he originally did not, because he didn't want people at Apple to think he was doing this for the money. But, Apple stock rose. The company really got back on track by 2000. And his first negotiated, and it was a negotiated option and remuneration package with the board, was a Gulfstream jet, as well as what turned out to be 20,000 options. Those options were in order to make the price at which he could exercise and the price he would pay as low as possible. You want that, right? Because you're going to get an option to buy a stock at a very low price. That's what an option is. That's called the strike price, the price on this piece of paper saying you have an option to buy X number of Apple shares. You want that as low as possible because you're going to hold it until you see the price go up substantially, and then you're going to exercise the option and realize, depending on whether you hold that cash, hold the stock or not after you buy it, you're going to realize a big gain. Some of it may be taxed at capital gains rates, some at ordinary income if you hold it, depending on how long you hold it. So the board, with Steve's full knowledge and what Isaacson doesn't say, but in other reports that relate to backdating options later, a few years later, with Steve's not only knowledge but also urging, backdated the options so that they could, from the day they were actually issued, putting a different date on them so the price would be lower in which he would be able to buy them and then sell them. With
and
great...
created a phony set of board minutes about a board meeting that never happened,
yeah,
and they admit that it never happened.
So there were a number of instances of pay in the form of stock options on Apple stock being issued to Jobs in which the backdating occurred. It occurred with regard to other employees as well. There was perhaps as much as 4,265 tranches of options. That's different collections of options on which backdating occurred. The problem legally was primarily a problem, interestingly enough, about reporting. You have to report what the actual you know, option prices, the strike price, so that you can report how much, in a sense, it's possible that the company is tithing away as compensation for accounting purposes. So Apple was called up by the SEC, and at least two employees, the former CEO, Fred Anderson, and general counsel, Nancy Heinen, were called up and prosecuted, both settled, ultimately settled. I believe both of them admitted neither admitted nor denied wrongdoing and paid penalties, and in each case I think had some kind of limitation on their activities as board members or in the financial markets for a certain amount of time. Jobs was never prosecuted.
Why?
And nor were other board members who admitted to staging to basically faking a meeting in which they could seal the deal of the actual date. Backdate on the options.
Yeah, but these other two Apple people, there were two Apple people, as you just said, that had to settle deals with the SEC.
Right.
There, to quote the New York Times, five executives of other companies went to prison for backdating options, but Jobs was never charged.
Sure.
The implication, at least to me, and I think it's where Marjorie was going, is that he was given special treatment. You don't buy that?
So what the article says at the very bottom was prosecutorial discretion. I think that discretion includes special treatment. You bet. And I don't think it was strictly limited to his health concerns because by the time this all came forward into the public eye, right, he had been public about the pancreatic cancer diagnosis. I don't think it was just the health.
I think he's a genius.
I think it was perceived that Steve Jobs is a genius, which is the if you will, the major chord of the symphony of this article, that he was a genius, he was a disruptor, his image and legacy are set in stone, including his behavior that was at very best legally dubious, if not outright illegal. I mean, I looked up a very interesting article in Slate written a few years ago by a guy named Daniel Gross called Snow Jobs. It's all about backdating. And it ends with this little line, which I think summarizes some of the at least publicly stated attitudes and behaviors of some of the entrepreneurs that we are lionizing in Silicon Valley right now with regard to existing regulations. Silly legal necessities? ? Some people call them laws. And I mean,
but Nancy, my sense is that's
heavy-handed. But come the hell on, we cannot have business, new business, innovative business, disruptive business being played on a playing field that says reality distortion field or not. We don't have to pay attention to regulations because they're old and don't obtain to us.
Well, I want to talk about these companies you mentioned a minute, like Uber and Airbnb. You use the term which I love, which I've never heard before: disruptive innovation. Where's that come? What does it mean exactly? I think I know what it means. What does it mean, and where does it come from?
I
love it.
The provenance of that really belongs to my colleague at the Harvard Business School, Clay Christensen, who many years ago wrote a really smash best-selling, really influential book called The Innovator's Dilemma, in which he argued that companies. He wasn't really talking about entrepreneurs per se. Companies come along and disrupt established players. Southwest disrupted by innovating on the spoke and hub system, by changing prices, and by only flying 757s, completely disrupted the U.S. airline industry. Mini steel mills, to use another example in his book, came along and flying underneath the radar of big companies like U.S. Steel, disrupted the global steel market. So, and he calls that disruptive innovation. And in the end, right, consumers in both these cases, businesses in the case of steel, travelers in the case, family consumers in the case of airlines, benefit. But it disrupts the silverback gorillas. They are barbarians at the gate. So the current kind of parlance and connotations attached to that word, disruptive innovation, which I'm sure Brian Chesky at Airbnb or Travis Kalanick at Uber, they would say, we are disruptive innovators. We're disrupting the taxi business. We're disrupting the hotel industry. And therefore, because we're disruptive and the laws were formulated to deal with established players, we can push the envelope on that. And none of them are saying exactly that, but that's certainly how they're acting.
But yeah, let me disagree with you. I'm always nervous to do this, considering your historic credentials about history. As you say that you put them in the same class, I don't mean in terms of success, the Uber CEOs, the whoever we were talking, Airbnb, which is a really interesting case. And again, I've used it in New York City. It is unbelievable. Talk about savings and great opportunities. You stay in people's apartments for great cheap, et cetera. And said, essentially, you know, they were ahead of the technology, for lack of a better. And I think it's true in that case. But the crimes and misdemeanors, the alleged crimes and misdemeanors of Steve Jobs were not at all, at least in my estimation, ahead of the technology. This anti-poaching stuff, that kind of stuff has been around forever. Yeah, options manipulation has been around forever. It seems to me there was either a spoken or unspoken deal. And the reason I say that is because in this New York Times piece, he is open about his flaunting of the law. What does he write to the head of Google or something? Okay. Basically talking about, Eric Schmidt, knowing that he's pretty much violating the law. And he's putting it in writing, which someone as smart as Jobs would not do, at least in my estimation, unless he had a sense that I'm invulnerable, I'll never get touched.
Well, exactly. And so what Walter Isaacson, the biographer, who's very careful, is quoted in this piece to say, I can't really comment knowledgeably on any of these specific cases, but let's admit it. Steve Jobs lived in a reality distortion field. And this is not justification at all. This is not, I believe, Isaacson justifying at all, in which he chose to park every single day or most days in the handicapped, I can't get over this, the handicapped parking space in the front of Apple headquarters. So even though he could have had and was offered, a CEO parking space, no, that I'm sure would have been just as close. No, he chose to park
Why?
He was a creep of a person. That is what Isaacson's book, when you get finished reading Walter Isaacson's book, he was horrible to his own children. And he was horrible to a lot of his employees. And when you talk about that distortion field, driving them to these ridiculous degrees of saying, we have to have this, the work that would take 6 months. We have to have this in 6 days. And if you have to work 24 hours a day for 6 days to get this, I don't really care. He was a nasty guy in many ways. I always find this, and maybe this is the female in me, I find it amazing that he's lionized. Yeah. And then you look at what he did to the workers he employed overseas, these horrible stories about the way people
about
were
Foxconn,
driven.
About Foxconn, the subcontractors iPhones.
And I know other computer companies are not so great either, but he seemed to think, just like I tell the story about other people I know, that famous people that park in handicapped spots, they don't think.
Never done it, Marjorie.
Not you.
Okay,
I mean, but famous people that I've said to you off the air.
The laws don't apply.
The laws do not apply.
I think it's more that. And if Isaacson needs to call it the reality distortion field, because he uses that term in the book, a wonderful book, by the way.
It is a great
eminently
book.
Readable, page-turner. He uses that term in the book to describe, and other people have said about Steve, when people would come to him and say, we can't possibly do this. We can't make, right, the iPhone with this wonderful touch phone screen when they were conceiving this in the mid-noughts. And Steve would say, we will do it. Right. And like as if reality doesn't apply to him. But what Isaacson is saying in applying that kind of terminology, I dream big things and we make them happen. Right. He's looking at the other side of the balance sheet on that, which is I can park in handicapped spots. I can demand from Eric Schmidt that regardless of antitrust regulations, which, by the way, my corporate counsel would have known. right? A lawyer in this article at Apple was clearly cognizant of these things. I can do that because I am Steve Jobs. And that's really the issue that I'm talking about here with all of – it's the Icarus syndrome. We get real close to the sun because of whatever we've done. And part of it, folks, is the money. Part of it is the astounding, fast, you know, stratospheric levels of wealth created, right, primarily through the financial markets, that we live in a world that we don't – where the old rules and just basic kind of, you know, everyday strictures of decency, like a handicap spot, is there for a reason.
Yeah,
I don't know
how many of you saw the
little piece in the Times yesterday that Ronnie Turco, the jockey who took Secretariat to fame in the early 70s, wouldn't go to the Derby this year because he fell off a horse in 1970, in the mid-70s, and was paralyzed, and there was no place for him to park. Right, so come the hell on.
That's why I didn't go to the Derby also. I had no place to park.
Forgive me.
I love that movie, Secretariat.
But these small things are there for a reason, and they're about decency. And so when people – and we all are subject to some of this. I worry that people making very influential decisions, right, in these companies that have, by virtue of their wealth and their products and our collective obsession with technology as some kind of holy grail, that people are not thinking with integrity, with care, with decency, with dignity about their actions in relation not only to themselves and their employees, but to all the people they influence.
Of course they're thinking about them, and they're saying we can get away. Yeah, sitting in your chair 2 days ago when Marjorie was away, Matt Taibbi wrote this book called The Divide.
Of course.
When we were talking about the failure of prosecuting on Wall Street, they understand when Lloyd Blankfein is invited to the first state dinner of Barack Obama, the message is sent, don't worry, boys. Steve Jobs apparently got the same message, but let's do current events for a second. We only have a minute or two left. This great line is Bloomberg News thing. Question, what's an automotive monopolist? Worst nightmare? Answer, Uber picks you up in a Tesla. And obviously the notion is virtually no regulations on Uber as compared to taxi companies. Obviously, Tesla wants to sell directly, not through these state-protected dealerships. But let's go to Airbnb as an example. You're sitting down with the executive at one of the coaching things you do, mm-hmm. and he says, listen, we're ahead of the technology. So as a result, the way we're going to make this much money is, one, it's appealing. You can go online and go directly.
Consumer
look at this beautiful
money.
Apartment, and it's one of the reasons I did it. No regulations at all. As far as I know, no hotel taxes, essentially undercutting all the existing laws. And he says, well, by the way, because the technology hasn't caught up with our kind of company, what kind of counsel do you give him? Hey, go for it, because the reality is these kind of innovative geniuses, these disruptors, for lack of a better expression, what's the Airbnb guy's name?
Brian Chesky.
Well, the Cheskys of the world, ultimately, the justice system treats them well because they are the ones who move the economy. So what advice would you give them?
My counsel, and I've been in this position, is really very clear. It's really – this is not complicated. The first line is the how of what you do is as important as the what. The how matters here for all kinds of reasons. At a large ethical level, which is very important, it matters because if everyone has the attitude of these disruptive innovators that regard regulation as as some kind of dispensable luxury or some kind of dispensable shackle on their ankle, right, then none of us can live well and decently and get our work done and raise our kids and try to live a reflective and interactive life in communion with others if we don't play by the rules.
Well, the Airbnb guy, though, then says to you, Nancy, well, then I can't make a huge amount of money. So give us an example
of
somebody.
Maybe he'll make a little less money.
Give us an example of somebody who we all know, whose business is totally cutting edge, who is, as far as you know, totally playing by the rules. Who would that be?
So, Howard Schultz at Starbucks, I've talked to him about before. He's playing by all the rules. Starbucks is doing they sell coffee, but they're doing all kinds of innovative things, right, around how you order your coffee and what digital technology can do and what you can do in a Starbucks store and how they're using that space and what they're trying to do for communities. And P.S., one of the most disruptive things they're doing is what Schultz and his team and the company have decided to do around social progress and politics and a big footprint creating jobs. They are disrupting every single old rule of corporate behavior that says business has no social responsibility.
So there you go, Jim.
And they're doing it cleanly, and they're doing it with health care benefits for their employees. And that, to me, is a great template. Let's learn from that kind of model and raise our kids to think about leadership in that guise.
Hey, before you go, very quickly, tell me, Nancy Kane, I don't want my imagery destroyed. Tell me you do not order venti. You say the size you want in traditional English. Is that true?
I say grande usually, or tall.
But, oh my God!
But remember, I wrote the first HBS case on Starbucks in 1996. So kind of got inculcated early.
Okay, you're forgiven.
Okay.
Nancy
it's
Kane,
okay
great to
order
see you.
Grande, and that was beautiful. I'm glad somebody is doing it right. Makes you think there's hope in the world. Anyway, Nancy Kane is an historian. Excuse me, at the Harvard Business School, where she holds the James E. Robeson Chair of Business Administration. Her latest book, Ernest Shackleton: Exploring Leadership. Full disclosure, we taped that interview with Nancy Kane yesterday, and after the show, she sent us this email. P.S. I just went back to Isaacson's biography of Jobs. He parked so often in the handicapped spot next to the front door that employees had signs made up saying, park different. And somebody painted the handicapped wheelchair symbol with a Mercedes logo since Jobs drove a Mercedes.
I love that story.
Okay. Thank you for listening to another edition of Boston Public Radio. Tune in tomorrow for New Yorker cartoonist Roz Chast on her new memoir. Also, Global Post Charlie Sennett joins us to go over international headlines. Our show is a production of WGBH, Boston Public Radio. Our production team, Chelsea Mers, Will Roselip, John Parker, and Amanda McGowan. I am Marjorie Egan.
And I am Jim Bradley.
Thanks for tuning in. Please tune in again tomorrow.